This is part 10 of the history of Israel, the 1970s, entitled Darkness and Light. As always, was sponsored by Becky and Avi Katz. Mazel tov to them as well, the birth of their son. Lili Nishmas Yona ben Rav Arye Leib, Tein Nishmas Surah B'Tzarah Chaim. After the death of Prime Minister Levi Eshkol in February 1969, Golda Meir becomes the fourth Prime Minister of Israel. By then, she's in her early 70s. She's the Secretary General of the Histadrut, and she was widely perceived as a caretaker because of her age and her background also, while new, more, so to speak, distinguished leaders would be groomed, maybe Defense Minister Dayan, maybe Foreign Minister Alon. For a variety of reasons, they couldn't win the votes in the Labor Party, so she was chosen. She was born in Kiev in 1898 and moved to, of all places, Milwaukee, Wisconsin at the age of 8. So she grew up in America. Her father was a carpenter. Her mother was a grocer. She attended public schools in Milwaukee and married her high school sweetheart named Morris Meyerson. And she made Aliyah together with him in 1921. She was 23 years old then. They briefly lived on Kibbutz Merchavia, but he was more urbanized. He didn't like it. They left. They moved to Yerushalayim. She, 5 years later, in 1928, took a job as the on the Histadrut Women's Council, Women's Labor Council, and they separated for all practical purposes. They lived apart for the next 23 years. He in Yerushalayim, she in Tel Aviv, and he died in 1951. They had two children. So she moved up the ranks. One of the few women actually became involved in politics. She was one of the only two women to sign Israel's Megillat Atzmut, the Declaration of Independence, and she said at the time that she thought, when she was signing, of the American signers of the Declaration of Independence in 1776, that she had studied in school. And when she studied them, she never thought they were real people. It's just, you know, names, John Hancock and others. But now she was signing, and it was overwhelming to her. She became, right after the War of Independence, Israel's first ambassador to the Soviet Union, very briefly, but enough to give one of the enduring images of the time, a famous scene of Golda Meir on Rosh Hashanah outside the Great Synagogue in Moscow, where the crowd lifted her on their shoulders and started to sing Jewish songs, which infuriated Stalin. Very shortly thereafter, she left, became a minister of labor in Ben-Gurion's government. After Sharet, she became the foreign minister. When people questioned Ben-Gurion, how could you appoint a woman a minister, he said, woman, she's the only man in my cabinet. But she retired in the early 60s because of illness. She had lymphoma, which eventually would kill her, but for which she was treated in the 60s. She's a chronic smoker, as we all remember. But she accepted the job of prime minister. She was always aided by Yisrael Galili, with whom she had a very close relationship over the years. Now, she made two very famous statements. I'm sure there are others as well, but two stand out. One, she said, soon after becoming prime minister, when asked about the plight of the Palestinians, she said, there's no such thing as Palestinians. Now, it sounds very quaint today, looking back. In fact, it was true then. It's a very tough sell today. If you think about it, though, the very first act of Arab terror on American soil was June 5, 1968, the first anniversary of the Six-Day War, when Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated by Sirhan Sirhan. He did it on the anniversary of the Six-Day War to protest Kennedy's pro-Israel leanings. You'll remember Sirhan Sirhan was defined as a Jordanian. He was called a Jordanian. Today we would say he's a Palestinian. He was from the village of Taiba, which is not far from Ramallah. If you saw yesterday's Times, that whole article on Taiba, the only remaining all-Christian city in Judea and Samaria, that's his hometown. That's where his family always lived. In fact, his father lived there when he killed Kennedy. But for some reason, usually if they do a profile of a village, they will say some famous personality that emerged from that village. They omitted that Sirhan was a native of Taiba. She also said, I quote, "I can forgive Arabs for killing Jews, but I cannot forgive the Arabs for teaching our boys to kill Arabs," which is a nice soundbite. and sounds very grandmotherly, but it never made any sense to me, and probably inappropriate for a leader to say that. There's no guilt in defending yourself, and who knows what price eventually would be paid for that type of mentality. Her first concern was the war of attrition, which was then raging. We discussed towards the end of last week's lecture constant shelling of the Israel's forces on the Suez Canal, fighting essentially a guerrilla war, but one launched by a sovereign nation, and its goal was to bleed Israel slowly with constant casualties and to sap their spirit, and in a sense it worked. Almost 700 Jews were killed during the War of Attrition. Israel then began in 1969 and 70 to retaliate with massive bombings of the interior of Egypt, including one that killed 47 girls in a schoolyard. All that, those bombings eventually led to a ceasefire through diplomacy in August of 1970. Now you recall again from last week, soon after the Six-Day War in November, the UN adopted Resolution 242, which called for Israel's withdrawal from, I quote, territories occupied in the recent conflict to, I quote, secure and recognize boundaries. In exchange, there would be security for all states in the region. Of course, the operative phrase, territories occupied, specifically deleted the definite article, so as to imply, at least, that Israel would not have to return all the territories occupied, which means the territories, but from territories, meaning it would be subject to negotiations. The problem, in retrospect, and we don't really have a chance even now to look back with complete retrospect, but what this did was enshrine the principle of land for peace as the inevitable solution to the problems in the Middle East. This is a dogma that has haunted diplomacy since then, because in fact there's no evidence that there is any solution. There's no evidence that this is the solution, land for peace, and it completely ignored the Arabs' philosophical rejection of the state of Israel. What it essentially declared or posited was that there's a dispute, that dispute revolves around land, territory, security, and boundaries, and if you put everything in the mix, you'll give a little here, a little there, everybody gets what they want, and everyone goes home happily. The problem, of course, is that if that is not so, but nonetheless, the world from then until now has adopted that as the only possible solution. Based on Resolution 242, the Secretary of State of the United States, William Rogers, adopted the Rogers Plan in 1969, the first of many, many plans named after people or places, all of which say basically the same thing. Israel should get out of these territories in exchange for peace. What Rogers did is add American security guarantees to Israel in the event of withdrawal. Now, this plan became the basis of the ceasefire in the War of Attrition, to be followed by the negotiation of Israel's withdrawal from Sinai, which was under the auspices of the UN envoy Gunnar Yaring. Now, Israel's acceptance of this framework, of the framework of the Rogers Plan, even if not the specifics, because the cabinet already in 67 had said that they would surrender land in exchange for peace, but Israel's acceptance of the Rogers and then Yaring framework led Begin and his Dachau party to finally leave the National Unity Government. Now, this diplomacy of Gunnar Yaring did not stop, even when Nasser died suddenly in September of 1970, replaced by his lackluster vice president, basically unknown then, former Air Force officer Anwar Sadat. Sadat had been a Nazi sympathizer as recently as the 1950s. Yaring made an offer to Israel with Sadat's approval, apparently. Israel would leave Sinai in exchange for peace with Egypt, period. Golda Meir rejected even a partial withdrawal, which again in retrospect is sad and ironic in light of the Yom Kippur War and the peace treaty of 1979, which we'll discuss, where in fact these very same terms were accepted. But you can't always look back, and hindsight is 20/20. And who says if history would be any better now if, in fact, she had accepted it. in the late 60s, early 70s, new forces entered Israeli society, all of which still exist today in one form or another. Already in 1967, just a few months after the war, the Eretz Yisrael Shlema movement arose, the Greater Israel movement, which called for massive settlement throughout the land of Israel. Acting on those impulses, Pesach 1968, Rav Moshe Levinger led a group of guests to the Park Hotel in Hebron. Like bad guests, they never left. And they don't leave until the government relents and allows them to build a permanent settlement in Kiryat Arba, which in fact they did do. Now this generated two approaches to settlement of these conquered lands. First was Moshe Dayan's. He maintained that it would be best for Israel to settle the Sumerian mountain range, to break the contiguity of Arab towns, which in fact they did eventually do, but much later on. The other approach was Yigal Alon's plan, was to settle Jews in blocks, East Yerushalayim, Gush Etzion, which Jews moved back a few months after the war, the Jordan Valley to serve as a buffer between the Arab cities in the Shomron and Jordan, the Golan, which the conventional wisdom was Israel would never return because of who they're dealing with in Syria. These two approaches, the difference between them was never resolved, and it's in fact never been settled. It was just joined by a third approach in the late 1970s, settling the entirety of the land of Israel for religious reasons. Something else happened just a few months after the war, 1967, Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, Zatzal, in New York, gave an interview when people spoke about annexing the land and opposing the surrender of land for peace after Resolution 242, as it was being negotiated. The Rav said, Rabbi should stay out of politics. We can live quite well without any holy places at all. The life is more important than any holy place. Decisions can only be made by military and political experts, not by Rabbanim. The Rav did not address what to do if the experts are actually corrupt bunglers and incompetents, that he did not address. But nonetheless, you have now those two sides also in existence. The religious advocates of settlement and a hard line, a settlement of the land of Israel on one side, and a minority religious opposition. The Rav's attitude was very much in consonance with the then Mafdal, the National Religious Party, Mizrahi. But that would be all preempted already by the middle 1970s when the old guard of Mafdal started either to die out or to retire or simply be supplanted by younger, much more right-wing, nationalistic groups and individuals. Something else arose, which is the luxury of a country which has now tripled its territory and is on a military high. That's the luxury of having an anti-war movement. April 28, 1970, 70 high school seniors send a letter to Prime Minister Meir urging her to embrace the peace mission of Nachum Goldman, famous self-appointed Jewish diplomat, who traveled to Egypt to negotiate with Nasser on his own. And they said if Meir does not accept Goldman's mission, they may, Ashar was the word they used, refused to enlist in the IDF. This would also presage similar movements which arose in the 80s and 90s and really until today. May 15, 1973, Abinatan, a Persian Jew, launches his peace ship and he vows to stay on the boat until there's peace. He's on the boat a long time. He's off the boat now. I think he's in a nursing home in Tel Aviv, but he closed down his boat with the signing of the Oslo Accords. He got started in 1968 when he flew his own plane and landed in Egypt on what he called a peace mission. He's lucky they didn't just shoot him down, but in fact they let him go the next day, and then he started the pro-peace and anti-war movement. Something else happened all around this time was mass aliyah from the Soviet Union. Between 1971 and 1974, almost 100,000 Jews were allowed to emigrate from the Soviet Union. In light of the Leningrad trials, which gave the Soviets a bad reputation, and the Six-Day War, and under the guise of family reunification, meaning those Soviet Jews who had family in Israel, they're allowed to leave. In a very short time, the exit visas dried up, And worse, the emigrants began dropping out in Vienna and going elsewhere, primarily to America, in some cases to Germany as well. With the Aliyah, the Russian Aliyah of the early 70s, there arose an Israeli peace, Israeli social movement, named, bizarrely enough, the Black Panthers, after the American movement, made up mainly of Sfardim, protesting discrimination against the Sfardim, and resenting the benefits that were being given to the new Olim. It launched the career of several people, became members of Knesset. Charlie Bitton is one name that comes to mind, but that movement also founded by the 80s. In November 1969, in the religious sphere, Israel TV began broadcasting on Friday night, Chil Shabbos, after the High Court upheld the discrimination suit of a Chiloni, who said he's being discriminated against by not being able to watch his favorite television shows on Friday night, and the courts upheld that, and it set off naturally protests, but again undermined some of the holiness of the land. The Langer case also was a great controversy in the early 70s. Two children, by then in their 20s, who were declared mamzerim in the early 1950s, the case was complicated, maybe another time we'll discuss it. Their mother had married a non-Jew in Europe. That non-Jew converted after they were married. The question was whether he converted kalocha, number one. He was a religious Jew after that, but suffice to say, they separated, divorced, they never got a get. She remarried, had two children, these Langer children. And when she was divorced a second time, or wanted to remarry after her husband died, they found out about the first marriage, the children were declared mamzerim. When they wanted to marry the late 60s, they were not able to. Rav Doran just became the chief rabbi. Somehow, controversy found a way to declare them not mamzerim, but it led to a tremendous negative reaction in the rabbinical world. The early 70s also, all these things in the wake of the Six-Day War, the Baal Tshuva movement really started. In the early 1970s, Or Sameach, Eish HaTorah, Neve Yerushalayim for women, they became magnets for Jews who wanted to return to their faith. Meanwhile, Panovich became the largest yeshiva in Israel. Rav Yaakov Yisrael Kanievsky, the Stipler Gaon, became the leader of Jews, at least in Bnei Brak, if not beyond that. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Reshiva Kol Torah, was the Posek Hador. Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, the Reshiva of Merkaz Harav. Those were the three main rabbinical luminaries who had tremendous followings. I should mention as well two other anecdotes. One great tragedy, January 1968, Israel's new submarine, the Dakar, leaves Portsmouth, England on its way to its base in Haifa. It disappears suddenly in the Mediterranean. All 69 are presumed dead. Searchers find nothing. Numerous conspiracy theories. What happened to it? The Rabbanut does free every married woman from being an aguna. And in fact, that sock was confirmed. The Dakar was located in May 1999, 360 miles west of Haifa in the Mediterranean, and the sailors, seamen, remained buried at sea. While we're at sea, in 1969, another Mossad triumph. You'll recall, after the Six-Day War, the French embargoed anything to Israel, refused to sell arms. In fact, they refused to allow five missile boats that Israel had already paid for to sail from Cherbourg to Israel, refused to release them. December 24th, in the evening, most non-Jews are tied up doing other things, the Mossad dispatches Israeli naval officers disguised as Norwegian longshoremen. They board the boats essentially to clean them or service them, and they just sail out of the harbor, and a week later they are in Haifa. Life changes in the most negative sense from 1968 on with the exponential rise in terror. The PLO becomes violently and persistently active after 1968 when Yasser Arafat becomes its head. Arafat was born in Cairo. I always pretend to be born in Yerushalayim, but in fact he was born in Cairo. He's really an Egyptian. In 1929, studied at the University of Cairo. Rumors that he fought in 48, but I don't know myself. He became an engineer in Kuwait, and then he founded Fatah, meaning conquest, in 1959, along with Abu Jihad, who will eventually be killed by the Israelis in the 80s. Arafat became known to all of us as not only a murderer, but also a thief and an embezzler. At his death, Western intelligence agencies estimated his net worth at $1.2 billion that he had just stolen from governments around the world that he kept in a variety of banks. But in fact, he changed the world in ways that, you know, we live with today that we think are normal. Plane hijackings. I was just talking to someone recently who said that they were going to Israel sometime in the late 60s and they need to go very quickly, and they just drove to the airport and just walked onto the plane. Now, who could think of doing something? Bought a ticket, the counter, walked onto the plane. Whole thing took maybe 30 minutes. So the time decided to go on the plane. Who would think of such a thing being able to occur today? Bus bombings, market bombings, cinema bombings. In 1968, there was a bomb, Maris HaMachpelah even, that wounded Jews. And retaliation became the norm as well. In 1968, almost 200 Arabs, Jordanians, were killed in Karama in a raid. That week, Arafat's picture was on Time magazine as a symbol of the Palestinian movement. This is 1968. December 1968, Israel destroys, blows up 12 Arab-owned planes in Beirut Airport. Again, in response to terror, to try to dry up the financial sources of terror money, which was the Arab countries, Israel adopts then a policy of no negotiation with terrorists. It has long since abandoned that policy, but the theory was it would only encourage more terror. In fact, every terror act, or certainly the hostage taking, always requested the release of prisoners. Arafat himself escaped Israeli capture in 1968, after the war. He went to Judea Samaria to try to foment strife. He was almost captured, but he fled to Jordan. In Jordan, he also was a troublemaker, and he was soon expelled from Jordan also in September 1970. What happened was the PLO, under a different name, had seized three foreign airliners and kept them on a Jordanian airfield for more than 2 weeks with its passengers. Rav Huttner Zatzal was one of the passengers on one of those planes. Eventually, the passengers were freed, the planes were blown up, but at that point, Hussein feared that Arafat was fomenting a revolution against him, and that became Black September 1970, a war between the Jordanians and the PLO. They were able to flee. They suffered tremendous losses. They fled to Lebanon eventually. Syria supported the PLO. Syria almost attacked Jordan. Syria is then run by Hafez Assad. They almost attacked Jordan because they're always rivals, but Syria was dissuaded from attacking when Israel, of all countries, mobilized troops in the Jordan Valley ostensibly to protect Hussein with the support and encouragement of the American government. But the Arafat was able to get to Lebanon. South Lebanon then became its base of operations, known as Fatah Land, with all the tactics that are now familiar to us, guerrilla raids, hiding among civilians, hiding behind civilians, hiding weapons in hospitals and schools and mosques, etc. But the terror continued from Lebanon and elsewhere. 1971, after two children were killed in Gaza, the head of the Central Command, Ariel Sharon, was tasked with ending terror in Gaza, and he does it brutally and efficiently, and Gaza was pacified for more than 15 years after that. In May 1972, a Sabena plane was hijacked in Lod Airport. Commandos freed the hostages. One was killed. Commandos dressed as technicians. The head of the unit was David Barak. One of the commandos was Benjamin Netanyahu. They stormed the plane. Terrorists were killed. 3 weeks later, it was a massacre at Lod Airport. 25 were killed, 71 were wounded. Only terrorist survivor was Kozo Akamoto of the Japanese Red Army, was sentenced to life in prison, 25 life sentences in prison, but he was freed in a prisoner exchange in 1985, and he's still alive. Japan, in shame, paid Israel more than $1 million because its citizens had perpetrated this massacre. Well, which led up to the Olympic massacre in the Munich in 1972, in September. Israel's suites in the Olympic Village were raided by Black September. Two were killed immediately after days of futile negotiations with Germany as the intermediary. There was a failed raid by the German police on the escape helicopter. 9 more Israeli athletes were killed over the years. As we know, the Mossad tracked down the planners, killed them all, killed also one innocent person, and as Avery Brundage famously said, the games must go on, and the games did go on. Now this put Palestinian terror on the world stage. Indeed, if Israel thought it would engender sympathy for Israel, in retrospect, it had the opposite effect. People then learned, I mean, Americans were riveted to the television then because the Olympics were on hold. People learned of Palestine, Palestinians, and they started to think, if they're so desperate, there must be something to it. This proved to be a winning strategy. Since then, no terror movement has failed to attract substantial Western support, not to mention that it also sowed fear amongst Westerners. March 1973, Black September terrorists seized the American Embassy in Khartoum in the Sudan, again seeking a prisoner release, including Sirhan Sirhan. They murdered 3 diplomats, including American counsel, Ambassador Cleo Knoll. This was a direct approval of Arafat. Now, this has some modern relevance also. This information was suppressed until just recently, although it was always suspected. The fact is, Arafat at the time offered to intervene, so to speak, as an intermediary between Black September and the Americans in order to distance himself from what was happening while simultaneously orchestrating the murders. Now, in fact, his voice was caught on tape in a phone conversation directly authorizing the killing of these diplomats. The State Department knew about this in 1973. They only released this information under the Freedom of Information Act in 2006. Only a few months ago did they release this. Otherwise, Arafat could have been subject to arrest on any of the dozens of times he came to visit Clinton in the 1990s. But for political reasons, that was suppressed. The conventional wisdom today, by the way, is that Black September was just an arm of Arafat. The terrorists in the early 70s embraced a tactic which became known to all of us. They used different names, leading simpleton media types to report, to intone, a previously unknown group carried out this terror. And they would just make up names. They do it today as well. But it's really the same group. Arafat, though, abandoned, so Black September was the wing of Arafat under his control, for which he was able to deny any complicity. Much like today, Al-Aqsa Martyr Brigade functions as a, so to speak, a loose wing of Fatah. Even though it's just a name and it's all the same group, sometimes the same people, certainly the paymasters are the same. Arafat, in fact, abandoned international terror in 1974 because of the bad publicity it engendered, concentrating on terror in Israel. Now, notwithstanding the terror, Israel really is on a wave of self-confidence, all of which leads to the prelude to the Yom Kippur War. David El-Azhar was appointed the chief of staff in 1972. Sharon was felt rebuffed, resigned from the army July 1973, went into business for a time. Israel's on a high. In the summer of 73, the Mossad reported that there is, quote, a low probability of war. They were grossly wrong, but they were so confident in their analysis that they ignored all the warning signs, which again, in hindsight, you see were there. The Soviets rearmed Egypt and Syria in the years after the Six-Day War, but Sadat, who threatened war right after he took over, and again, very passionately, 1971, if he doesn't get the Sinai back, he's going to war. He expelled, in July 1972, his Soviet advisors and military officers so he can carve a more independent course. In September of 1973, Israel ignored an Egyptian-Syrian military buildup as normal maneuvers. September 13th, Israel shoots down 13 Syrian MiGs in a dogfight over the Mediterranean. By September, the Mossad was predicting war, but apparently a lot of this is shrouded in the double talk. Army intelligence still said not. King Hussein warned Israel of war, even flying to Tel Aviv secretly on September 25th to meet with Golda Meir. It was ignored as well. America was caught by surprise, as one State Department intelligence officer said, "We were brainwashed by the Israelis who brainwashed themselves. By Friday, Golda Meir knew of impending war, even though Dayan still believed it might not happen, and she faced the choice, the Zerav Yom HaKippurim, of mobilizing reserves and launching a preemptive strike. The Americans, by then Henry Kissinger was the Secretary of State, he warned Israel not to strike first. He said America would only help Israel if there's no first strike, and Kissinger himself later admitted in his memoirs that he wanted Israel, I quote, bloodied a little for diplomatic purposes. Now, Golda Meir flinched. She, in fact, ordered a partial mobilization of troops, but no first strike. Not even Yom Kippur morning, when the attack was imminent. David Elazar, who would take the weight of the blame for the war, was arguing even then for a first strike Yom Kippur morning, but he was also rebuffed. It's a tough choice. Some of her, again, in hindsight, is always 20-20. Some of her defenders say she was right, because, as we'll see, Israel benefited from an American airlift during the war, which really rescued it. On the other hand, they might not have needed an airlift had they taken the first strike and set the Arabs back on their heels. War broke out, combined the Egyptian-Syrian attack at 2 p.m., Shabbos Yom HaKippurim, October 6th, and the attack was brutal. In all, 10 countries sent troops, including our good friends in Iraq, who sent a division of 18,000 soldiers. Jordan did not send any forces at all. Now, the Barlev line, which was Israel's static defense line along the Suez, was crushed by tens of thousands of shells, and it's painful even to read the statistics. At once, 10,000 Egyptian soldiers crossed the canal on pontoon bridges, 10,000 soldiers faced by 450 Israeli reservists, who by and large were either massacred or captured. Only one position was held. If you look at the map you have before you, number one, to the right area is Israel's position. You see the arrows, all the points of attack of the Egyptians. The only place where the Israelis really held, in fact they held the entire war, was opposite Port Said. The northernmost position was never taken by the Egyptians. One post held out against tremendous odds for a week before they were all captured. There was bitter fighting. The Israeli Air Force entered the battle and was routed in the early going as Egypt's new SAM anti-aircraft missiles just shot them down, and there were heavy air losses. Meanwhile, a similar disaster was brewing on the Golan. If you look at map number two, as we go from right to left, crossing the thick line, which was the ceasefire line of 73. Syria easily broke through. Again, the numbers are staggering. 2,000 Syrian tanks broke through against 188 Israeli tanks. The heaviest fighting was on Sunday as the IEF tried to buy time for a full mobilization. Some say, by the way, in retrospect, that it turned out to be a blessing with Yom HaKippurim because it made mobilization easier. Everyone was either at home or in shul. But again, they were at home or shul because they weren't on the front lines, which made the initial attack easier. Syria advanced all the way to the Geshur Benot Yaakov on the Jordan River. If you look at the map three, you see it most clearly. You see it in two as well. But if you look at the middle, it looks like a nose sticking out. See how close they are to the Jordan River. That's right where the Geshur Benot Yaakov is, which we always take on the way to the Golan Heights north of the Kinneret. They were very close. Tveria was in sight. They were 7 kilometers from the Kinneret. On the very first day of the war, the Syrians captured Har Hermon. Monday, October 8th, the third day of the war, was one of the darkest days in the history of the IDF. Their counterattack failed, both in Sinai and on the Golan. A division of Bren Adan, was to link up with a division commanded by Ariel Sharon, who had re-enlisted and taken over a division. But Sharon was sent elsewhere. And again, you know, people critical of the IDF in the last war, justifiably so, every war has these types of failures. Sharon was sent by command somewhere else. Bren's division was faced Egypt's Third Army alone. He himself lost 400 tanks. On the Golan, one of the great, the legendary figures of the war, Avigdor Kalani, later went into politics, almost single-handedly held off Syrian tanks. The story is he himself disabled 33 Syrian tanks on his own. Dayan was in despair because there was nothing to hold either Egypt or Syria back. He calls a press conference, of all things, announces a press conference, this might lead to Khurban Bayit Shlishi, the destruction of the Third Temple. He resigns. Meir refuses to accept his resignation. Dayan asks to use nuclear weapons, and Meir says, not yet. If you look at the map 3, you see the Syrian advance through Kunetra, all the way on the first day of the war to that point right in the middle. You see where they are. On the south as well, up to El Al, it's just a few minutes, maybe 20 minutes to Tveria. But at the middle point, there was nothing in front of them. And here we come to Anais. And I spoke to someone who was there that day. And he said there was no reason why they stopped. The Syrians just stopped their advance. After the war, they would say they saw no Israeli soldiers, and they assumed they're waiting in ambush. They decided to wait a half day for reinforcements to come to take on the hidden Israeli soldiers. In fact, they could have captured Tveria, and they could have just marched westward towards the Mediterranean, cut Israel in half. But they just stopped. They stopped right there. As it was on that day, Egypt stopped as well. Even after defeating Bren's force, they could have moved forward into Sinai. They stopped also. Sadat later said that they stopped because all he wanted was to recapture the canal. That was it. In fact, it may be true, may not be true, because the following week, he did again attack. But when they could have attacked, they did not. The tide really turned on Tuesday the 9th, when there was already full mobilization, the IF had solved his SAM missile problem, the battle shifts. Damascus is bombed for the first time. Israel focused, by the way, on the Golan, because they had the Sinai as a buffer. There's no buffer on the Golan. But supplies were running low. Sharon writes this in his autobiography. They had a day's worth of bullets left by the end of the first week, running low on planes, on artillery shells, on tanks, on ammunition. Nixon is in Florida now, hiding from the ravages of Watergate, distracted by Watergate, really no friend of the Jews, but in a, again, unbelievable act, he tells Kissinger to rearm Israel. Now, Kissinger objected at first, as did the Pentagon. The Pentagon said they don't want to divert anything from the war effort in Vietnam. You think that was the same language that Roosevelt and his acolytes had used in World War II. They didn't want to divert anything from the war effort to help the Jews. Nixon said no, and he said, I quote, send everything that can fly. And in an amazing historic airlift during the war, probably 1,300 C-5 cargo missions were flown from America to Israel. Those are large cargo planes. They flew with untold amount of ammunition, just replenishing Israel's stores. Europe, already caving to Arab terror and fear of the oil weapon, refused to allow the American planes any overflights, any landings, so America had to stop and refuel in the Azores, which was an American base off the coast of Portugal. Even with Portuguese, Portugal has its own oil, had their own oil coming from Angola. They didn't have to worry about the Arabs. Every Air Force base was mobilized to send arms to Israel. Wright-Patterson, Dayton, where my wife was born, McGuire, right here in New Jersey. They would just use everything that week focused on getting supplies to Israel. Now, why did Nixon do it? Why did he do it? Zashkocha brought this also, but the conventional wisdom is that he was afraid that Israel would use its nuclear weapons, and the world would then find itself in a different type of conflagration, so he wanted to ward that off. But in fact, for all Jews who hate Nixon so much and love Roosevelt so much, you just look at their reaction to Jewish Tzara, and it at least caused for some rethinking. With the new weapons, on October 11th, there was a counterattack on the Golan. Raful Eitan, another famous figure, recaptured the entire Golan Heights. Kahalani's brigade destroyed more than 300 Syrian tanks in a valley that became known as Emek HaBacha, the Valley of Tears. Very fierce fighting. and the Golan was freed, and again under Israel's control, although not yet Har Hermon. October 13th, which is exactly a week after the war, the Shabbos Chol HaMoed Sukkos, the largest tank battle in history took place at the Mitli and Gidi passes, which if you look carefully in the map, map number one, you see to the bottom right, as in fact the Egyptians, these are passes through the mountain range that cuts north-south in Sinai. If you get through the passes, it's smooth all the way into the rest of Israel, although it's still a little distance. Very fierce fighting. General Albert Mangler was killed. You don't often find generals killed in battle, but he was killed. The counteroffensive then begins. Sharon devised a plan to cross the Suez in the seam between the Egyptian 2nd and 3rd armies. And that he does on October 14th with a very small force. If you turn the page, look at map 5, you'll see exactly where he crossed. The Egyptian 3rd Army is at the bottom on the eastern side in Sinai. He crosses north of there. In fact, he crosses north of the Great Bitter Lake. That area in the black becomes the area that Israel took over. So that seam between the 2nd Army above and the 3rd Army below, that becomes Sharon's crossing point. There's major fighting to get there. It was called the Chinese Farm, which was an irrigation project east of the canal that was actually undertaken by Japanese, but they couldn't tell the difference, I suppose, called the Chinese Farm. Yitzhak Mordechai, later defense minister, was ambushed, heavy losses, but Israel held their position, and October 14th and 15th started to ferry more tanks and troops across the canal. When Sharon did this, by the way, they had no pontoon bridges, so he had to improvise with rafts just to establish a presence on the other side until after a day or two, the engineers figured out a way to get everyone across. The Egyptian Third Army was soon surrounded by the Israelis on one side and the Great Bitter Lake on the other side, and they were, in fact, surrounded, could have been destroyed. In the meantime, Israel could have marched to Cairo as well. By October 15th, the Syrians are off the Golan. Israel's pushing towards Damascus, which is now 40 kilometers away, 28 miles, if you look, 25 miles, if you look at the top. Number four, you'll see exactly where they were pushing. They're very close. So with Israel on the march, the Soviets and the UN then become heavily involved in ceasefire talks. The Soviets threaten intervention. The Americans threaten retaliation, and in fact, this is the most recent time, and probably the closest the world ever came to a nuclear showdown outside the Cuban Missile Crisis. America raised its worldwide alert to DEFCON 3. DEFCON 1 is all-out war. There was, in fact, even a nuclear alert that was declared in America as the Soviets made their threats. Kissinger flew to see Brezhnev. They agreed, along with Egypt and Israel, to a ceasefire. Fighting continued nonetheless. Israel tried and failed to capture the town of Suez, which, as you can see, is right off the Little Bitter Lake in the map. 80 soldiers, unfortunately, were killed in that futile effort. But they do retake Har Hermon in the Golan on October 22nd. By October 27th, the fighting had stopped. The war ends. Israel then begins its futile diplomacy. They first agreed to allow food and water to reach the starving Third Army, Egypt's Third Army, which is now completely deprived of all its resources. There was no agreement, any disengagement of forces. If the world was normal, and you look at the map, and you'll see the Egyptians on the east side of Suez, and the Israelis on the western side of Suez, so you would say, well, you want to be fair, let the Israelis pull back to their side, and the Egyptians pull back to their side. No such luck. Victory is snatched away. Everyone always praises Israel's diplomats, Abba Ibn and others. It's not right for me to criticize, but it always occurred to me that the Israeli diplomats are a lot like being the best players on the Cubs, the Chicago Cubs. You may be good, but you never win anything. And that, in fact, is what happened. They negotiate themselves into what becomes then, in the minds of the Arabs, a victory. November 15th is a prisoner of war exchange between Egypt and Israel. Again, completely disproportionate. 8,000 Egyptian soldiers exchanged for 238 Israeli soldiers. Syria refuses. They refuse for good reasons. The Syrians are probably the most brutal, vicious murderers in a region that has a number of brutal, vicious murderers. I'll just read a little selection. The Syrian Minister of Defense, Mustafa Tlas, who served for 30 years under Hafez al-Assad, addressed the Syrian National Assembly in December 1973, awarding medals to a variety of troops. And he said as follows, there's an outstanding, in fact, if you look at the map, you'll see in map number 4, a little asterisk-like symbol, places where Syrian troops murdered Israeli soldiers after they were captured. Ramat Makshimim, Tel Faris, etc. But Mustafa Tlas said in the Syrian National Assembly, there's an outstanding case of a recruit from Aleppo who murdered 28 Jewish soldiers all by himself. These are prisoners. Slaughtering them like sheep. All his comrades in arms witnessed this. He butchered 3 of them with an axe and decapitated them. He struggled face to face with one of them and, throwing down his axe, managed to break his neck and devour his flesh in front of his comrades. This is a special case. Need I single it out to award him the Medal of the Republic? I will grant this medal to any soldier who succeeds in killing 28 Jews, and I will cover him with appreciation and honor his bravery. That, unfortunately, is the type of enemy that Israel's forced to fight and even to negotiate with at times. Kissinger begins his shuttle diplomacy designed to bring the parties to a Geneva peace conference in December. PLO will be excluded. The peace conference takes place, ends a day or two later. Nothing much happens. Kissinger's pressure is intense. By February 1974, Israel had withdrawn from Egypt. Egypt's forces were reduced, but they remained in Sinai. Soon the Suez Canal reopened. It had been closed since the Six-Day War. Israeli shipping was allowed, but under a neutral flag, little progress in Syria. But in Israel, depression set in. Results of the war were disastrous. Almost 2,700 soldiers killed, 7,000 wounded. There were protests in the street for a commission of inquiry. Such a commission was formed. The Agronat Commission, Shimon Agronat was the Chief Justice. Rav Nevensol's father, by the way, served the commissioner, Dr. Yitzhak Nevensol, who had been the state controller for many years, a very, very honest figure, a person of tremendous integrity. There was a sense they'd almost lost. You recall, after the war, the next year, the most popular song was Yehoram Gaon's Ani Maftiach Lach, Yada Shalik Tana, Shezoke Milchama Achrona. This will be the last war, because the longing for peace is understandable, but it led to irrational behavior. It's interesting that the song was partially true, because in fact, that was Israel's last conventional war in 1973, as the Arabs since then have been more successful in achieving their strategic goals through negotiation or terror or guerrilla warfare. So it really was the last conventional war. Adding to the mood of despondency, Ben-Gurion died in December. And yet, in December 31st, new elections re-elected Golda Meir as prime minister, but with a much smaller margin of victory. In April of 74, the Agronat Commission issues its report. It blames Dado el-Azhar, Shmuel Gonen, who was the head of the Southern Command, had taken over for Sharon in the Southern Command, and Eliezer Zeira, who was the head of Army Intelligence. Each deny their guilt, each point fingers at others. Zeira writes a book, which I read, a very compelling book, why he was the one who was telling them that war was coming, and everyone else didn't listen to him. But who knows? Dado el-Azhar will die a year or so later, of a heart attack. People are up in arms because Meir was let off the hook, and Dayan was let off the hook. Meanwhile, the Arabs start their oil embargo that drains away whatever little international support Israel had. People protested the whitewash of the politicians. It was. The three blamed were dismissed, but Golda Meir and Moshe Dayan soon resigned within a week after the commission's report. The very next day, April 11, 1974, a school in Kiryat Shmona seized. 18 hostages are killed, mainly women and children. A month later, 22 more women and children are killed in Malot. The school, teachers and students again. A little controversy. There are some teachers who actually fled when the terrorists came in, leaving the children behind. Another outcome of the war, which is important again for today, the sense that Israel has to become more independent in its weapons production. So April 1975, Israel unveiled the Kfir, its own airplane, and 2 years later, it produced its first Merkava tank. Within a month after, or 2 months after Meir resigned, the new Prime Minister, Yitzhak Rabin, who was untainted by the war, having spent most of the previous 6 years as ambassador to the United States, he is left to deal with the disillusionment and the protests and Kissinger and the terror as well. Rabin was the first Sabra Prime Minister, born in 1922, a very dour and taciturn figure, almost without, he was not a very warm personality. One famous story, Jimmy Carter had a habit of taking every foreign leader after their dinner to see his daughter Amy asleep in her bedroom. Come look at my cute daughter. So he, when Rabin was over the first time, Carter said to him, you want to see Amy? And Rabin said, no, and walked away. Rabin was the Minister of Labor during the war. When he was elevated by the party to be Prime Minister, he ran against Shimon Peres, and they'd be rivals until the end of their lives, beat him by 41 votes. Remember, Peres had been in the Rafi party, so that still ruffled some feathers. Peres became a defense minister. Israel was now on the diplomatic defensive. Arafat came to the United Nations November 1974. Hard to imagine something could happen, but worse has happened since then. He came, said famously, I come bearing an olive branch and a freedom fighter's gun. Don't let the olive branch fall from my hand. He carried a gun with him, had the gun on the podium. The gun, in fact, was unloaded. But Arafat was the very first leader of a non-governmental organization to ever address a plenary session of the General Assembly. Peace for Arafat was, and he said it then, and I quote, Israel's destruction and nothing else. And he never wavered. Of course, by the 1990s, Israelis were tone deaf and only hearing what they wanted to hear. The PLO was then designated as the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people, given permanent observer status at the UN, but in effect treated as a state. And then the United Nations began its annual ritual of dedicating at least a dozen resolutions per year denouncing Israel for one crime or another, all culminating in November 10, 1975, Zionism is Racism resolution. Chaim Herzog, who was Israel's representative at the UN, stood at the podium, tore up the document. He said later, it just came to him spontaneously, remembered his father, Rav Herzog Zatzal, had done that to the British White Paper in 1939. World terror now had a goal and support and mission and a target. I remember I was in Yerushalayim at the time. A few days after that, I went to hear a speech for American students at the Mishkan HaNasi by the Foreign Minister, Abba Ibn, and I walked up to him afterwards and I said to him, Do you think that Israel should now leave the UN? You know, if they don't appreciate your existence like they do. So he looked down at me, even though he was shorter than me, only he could do such a thing. He looked down at me and he said, they don't like me in the Knesset either, and I'm not leaving. So I was about to say to him, but they don't deny your right to exist in the Knesset, but he already turned away to deal with more important people. In the wake of the Yom Kippur War, Gush Emunim was founded. The soul-searching after the Yom Kippur War. People thought if the land was not settled, we don't deserve it. So all spearheaded by Rav Kook, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kohen Kook, Rav Kook's son, and his disciples, Rav Levinger, Rav Oldman, Hanan Parat, and others. Hanukkah 1975, they took over an abandoned railway station at Sebastia, old British railway station. Peres negotiates with them for days, finally agrees to move them to a nearby area. That becomes Elon Moreh, one of its founders, Rav Menachem Felix, who's a frequent visitor here. Ofra, the settlement, then begins as well. 2 months later, I plant a tree there, which still stands, I guess, somewhere there. This would set off years of controversy in Israel as the national consciousness of religious Jews was awakened. No longer be content to be cheerleaders, or as someone said, just the mashgichim for the Labor Party. Now religious Jews would seize their role in shaping Jewish destiny. and soon after they became the dominant force in the Mazdal, until today really, although not everyone likes it. Conversely, March 30th, 1976, Land Day, famously in Israel, Israeli Arabs riot in the Galil, protesting land seizures, discrimination, etc. Six are killed. Every year, commemoration, they riot again. 1975, Israel's forced to leave Syria, return to Netra. If you look at the extent of the holdings in map number four, they were forced to move west. Knetra was returned. On both fronts, Israel, despite ultimately winning on the battlefield, lost on the negotiating table. This retreat came after Israeli resistance provoked President Ford into what he called a reassessment of U.S. foreign policy towards Israel, holding off on weapon shipments and, in fact, calling for reevaluation of where America stands in order to pressure Israel. Now, Congress balked, and the reassessment ended, but Israel caved in any event. Syria gained the negotiation what they could not gain on the battlefield. At the same time, the Abu Rodeis oil fields were surrendered to Egypt. Israel buys their oil from Egypt ad hayom, despite everything else. Never stopped. Terror also didn't stop. March 1975, Hotel Savoy in Tel Aviv. The raid worked this time. The other raids, Kiryat Shmona, Maalot, did not work, but it took a psychological toll. Even Tel Aviv is not safe. July 7, 75, refrigerator bombed Kikar Tzion. Kikar Tzion, Yerushalayim, became a central target. 13 were killed again in November, and there were no solutions. In June of 76, Air France flight to Israel from Paris was hijacked in Entebbe, to Entebbe. All the passengers were released, except for the Israelis and the Jews. July 4th, bicentennial, daring raid. All the hostages were rescued, except for one who died in the hospital. The leader of the operation, Yonatan Netanyahu, was killed, but the rescue gave a tremendous boost. And I remember I was there that day. It was a sense that he nei lo yanum v'lo yishon shomei Yisrael. And whatever depression set in after the Yom Kippur War was in large part lifted after Entebbe. It restored the national pride. And the world was stunned that such a thing could happen. So much so that the very next week, Rina Mar from Israel won the Miss Universe pageant, which, trust me, would not have happened before that. Now, that's not a comment on her looks, but it's a comment on Israel standing in these world events. Now, Rabin's end was near as well. December 20th, 1976, three F-15s arrived in Israel after Shabbos, Israel's first F-15 fighter jets. Because of Chil Shabbos, the Mafdal abstained in a no-confidence vote. Rabin won the no-confidence vote anyway, but in a fit of pique, declared new elections for May. Meanwhile, in April, it was revealed that Leah Rabin, his wife, held a bank account in Washington, D.C. from the time they were still living there, which was illegal, against Israeli law. Rabin resigned. He announced his resignation to show where the minds of the people are. I don't think America is any different. That night, Maccabi Tel Aviv won the European Basketball Championship over a team from Italy. Tal Brody, the captain, an American, said, "Anachnu ala mapa, now we're on the map." Rabin had to delay his announcement until after the game. And after the game, it was midnight, he went on television to announce he's resigning as prime minister. Around the same time, Aaron Yadlin, who was one of the heads of the Bank of Israel, was jailed in a bribery and embezzlement scandal, and the housing minister, Avram Ofer, committed suicide when corruption charges were leveled against him. He shot himself. Even though it turned out he was innocent, he was just so ashamed of even being accused. Peres was elected the chair of the party in a stunning upset. Menachem Begin was elected prime minister after 9 consecutive defeats. Now, the polls had predicted it. Nobody really thought it would happen, though. Labor lost because of the corruption and the residual Yom Kippur, residual dismay from the Yom Kippur War. Likud had 43 seats, only a 4-seat gain from 1973. The Marath lost tremendously, down to 32. The new party, Dash, Demokrata v'Shinui, Yigael Yadin, the archaeologist, 15, Maftal 12, Aguda 5, Sharon had his own party, Shlom Tzion, which then joined Likud. So Begin first formed a government with 62, him and the religious parties. He drew significant Sephardi support, which put him over the top. within a few days, though, he co-opted Moshe Dayan as the foreign minister against the will of his comrades in the Likud. For credibility's sake, the Likud was plagued for many years with the feeling that they're not really the legitimate rulers, that labor should rule. He wanted even legitimacy in Israel. Dayan's condition, no annexation of Yesha, and Begin agreed, probably a mistake. Within a month or so, Dash joins as well, so Begin has a government of 78. The Mafdal, also tied to the past, tried to get labor in the government. Labor refused. Labor tried to keep the Mafdal out of the government by saying they have a historic relationship between labor and the Mafdal, and if they join the Likud, it'll be a betrayal of that relationship. Politics is politics. Begin goes to the Kotel at first. Next day, to Elon Moreh, a dedication to Sefer Torah. He promises there many more Elon Morehs. He chides a reporter who says to him about building the occupied territories. Begin says to him, these are not occupied territories, but liberated territories. Get used to the expression. The world freaks out. Time magazine that week, you all remember, Begin rhymes with Fagin. Carter sees his Middle East vision threatened. He introduces the phrase, obstacle to peace, tries to intimidate Begin at the very first meeting they have. Even Israelis are frightened because a new type of prime minister, comfortable with tradition, with Torah. He came to New York, he would visit the Rav, visit Moshe Feinstein, Lubavitcher Rebbe. He tried to change Yom HaShoah to Tisha B'Av, as we discussed once before. Begin for years, even when he was prime minister, but certainly when he lived in Tel Aviv, always had open Shal Shudas, Shabbos afternoon. Anybody could come into his house to ask him any question over Shal Shudas late in the day. Motzei Shabbos, even the prime minister's residence, Rehavia, he continued what he had done in Tel Aviv. He would invite people from a cross-section society to discuss the parsha of the week, getting opinions of philosophers, businessmen, thinkers, writers, etc., just to discuss Torah. Simple people. He would daven in the great synagogue, just take a short walk from his house. He had master twice a year, his birthday, his Shabbos Nachmu, hence the name Menachem, and on the second day Rosh Hashanah, the yard site of his parents, who were killed by the Nazis, he was incorruptible. And I was just reading an article last week, the revisionists are now yearning for a Begin-type figure. Came to power, owned one suit, lived his whole life until after he left office in a small apartment in Tel Aviv, nothing else. And he restored a sense of Jewish pride to Israel, in the land, in the heritage, in the Torah. And people felt that boost. In October, Uri Zohar, comedian, actor, announced his Chazarah B'Tshuvah. Already on his TV show, he started wearing the helmet and tzitzis, and his friends thought it was a comic stunt. Then he denounced what he called, I quote, the superficial secular life, and that he's leaving it to enter yeshiva, and they realized it wasn't a stunt. He visited here about 5 or 6 years ago. Others follow as well. In 78, in April, Israel wins the Eurovision Song Contest, Abanibi, which I'm proud to say was written by my late cousin, Ehud Manor. Now, Begin had certain problems as prime minister, mainly, at first, economic. Begin sought to dismantle the socialist economy, and this almost brought about a revolt because the people hardest hit were the poor, who his supporters. High inflation set in right away because prices adjusted themselves to market value when the subsidies were reduced. The economy had to be freed from its stranglehold. Begin started the process, but it took 25 years to accomplish with a lot of tough love. You have to remember, I think many of you will, it's a trip down bad memory lane. In Israel in the 70s, the highest income tax rate was 90%. 90%. Bureaucracy and red tape prevented private enterprise. I know Jews who took their businesses, American Jews, took their business to Egypt rather than Israel because they couldn't take dealing with the bureaucrats there. All contracts favored the workers or tenants and were biased against the owners and the landlords. All housing looked the same in classic socialist fashion. Government monopolies ran everything, and there was no one to talk to. Banks charge you to deposit money and charge you again when you withdrew your money. It took at least a year to get a phone. I personally know a story where someone knew Begin and called him to ask for his help in expediting a phone for his new apartment in Israel. And Begin, as prime minister, succeeded in getting Bezek to deliver the phone after 9 months. That was the prime minister. You're not allowed to own foreign currency. The VAT doubled prices on cars and appliances. Inflation reached 116% in 1979 with Bedevil Begin and then Shamir. They had to deal with it somehow to free the Israeli economy from the shackles of the socialists, but that's why it prospered already in the late 90s and until today. Dozens of settlements were established during his time, especially when Sharon was the Minister of Agriculture. The Yeshiva population quadrupled to 20,000, today more than 250,000. But Begin, of course, is best known for the foreign policy issues, and which we'll end with this tonight. Begin set out to reassure the world of his peaceful intentions. In July 1977 at the White House, Kedarko Bakodesh, he lectured Carter on Jewish history, on the Bible, on Eretz Yisrael. He brought maps, and Carter just tuned him out. Carter was a Southern Baptist. He wasn't a Christian evangelical. With Carter pushing to reconvene Geneva, and Sadat sending out private feelers to Begin, secret meetings began in the summer between Dayan and the Moroccan foreign minister, all of which led to Sadat's announce in November that he would even go to Jerusalem to make peace. An invitation duly followed. Sadat showed up. It took 4 days. From the time he said it to the time he showed up, Motzei Shabbos, November 19th, 1977, at Ben-Gurion Airport, everyone came out to greet him. Now, Sadat, I note, had been a Nazi sympathizer. He claimed he wanted just a foothold in Sinai, not to destroy Israel. Nonetheless, Israel was greeted by remarkable crowds lining the streets and the highways. The fact that at the King David Hotel he wore a tie with a swastika pattern escaped their notice. It did not escape my notice, though. For years, I saved the picture of it. The fact that his speech in the Knesset called for a Palestinian state and a complete withdrawal to 1967 borders made no difference to anyone. Whether he was sincere or not, the fact is, it was finally an Arab leader who came to Israel and even said the words recognition, acceptance, peace. That was enough to send Israelis into a tizzy and ignite the peace camp. Already in the early 1970s, American Jews, left-wing Jews, formed an organization called Brera. All these organizations are just publicized and live off the New York Times. It's a handful of people. They favored recognition of PLO, Palestinian State, and Yesha. It was held by the mainstream to be extremists, and they were. Unfortunately, time caught up with them, and their doctrines, which were anathema in the 70s, became government policy in the 90s. The PLO never agreed to this, but it started American Jews' intrusion into Israeli policy, which has not stopped, like B'nai Sherm, for example, and the harmful practice of Jews negotiating with themselves, assuming the enemy will go along, which has happened for the last 35 years. We make concessions to each other, and the Arabs will sit back and let us talk. To the Arabs, Brera, like others, were useful idiots. With Sadat's arrival, a new group called Peace Now arose. They began protests and rallies and demonstrations to force peace, as if the only obstacle was Israel's concessions. The problem was the Israeli government, including Begin, bought into this by embracing 242 and its sister 338 after the Yom Kippur War, as if land for peace would solve everything. Begin visited Ismaili in December, later went to Alexandria. Talks began, but stumbled on obvious issues. Sadat demanded full withdrawal from Sinai and a Palestinian state. Negotiations broke down after the first Israeli invasion of Lebanon in March 1978, March 12th, Operation Litani. It was after Arafat had started the civil war in Lebanon in 75. Lebanon was his terror base. Terrible incident on March 12th. Terrorists landed at Kibbutz Magan Michael, north of Netanya, commandeered a bus from Haifa in a shootout called the Coastal Massacre. 37 people were killed, 76 wounded. The operation was to eliminate terrorists up to the Litani River and install a friendly Christian army led by Saeed Haddad. So it worked temporarily. But in 3 days, the PLO were cleared from South Lebanon, relocated to Beirut, from where they would continue to murder and maim Jews and non-Jews. with the talk stalled, Carter invites, so to speak, Begin and Sadat to Camp David, Maryland in 1978, September. The news blackouts. Over 12 days, they hammer an outline of an agreement, full withdrawal from Sinai over 3 years, including settlements. Begin was most reluctant to withdraw from any settlement. He said before he's going to retire to the settlements in Sinai. He was persuaded by Weizmann, Sharon, Dayan, Aaron Barak as well, was his legal counsel. Dayan again threatened to resign if he didn't sign. Demilitarization of Sinai. Egypt adhered to this, by the way, until Sharon brought them back in 2005. Autonomy for the Palestinians. Most difficult, and probably the thing which is most longest lasting, Begin signed to and recognized what Carter called the, quote, legitimate rights of the Palestinian people. This began the protracted course of Israeli retreat and surrender. Whereas Begin gave away this chip, so to speak, of Palestinian rights for nothing, because they weren't part of negotiations. Sadat wanted it to cover as the Arab world was apoplectic at his breaking ranks, but once you say the Palestinians have legitimate rights, then any Jewish possession of the land is illegitimate, and we suffer from that until today. Ended Sunday night, September 17th, Begin addressed, I'll never forget, the audience in English. Then he said, I want to say some words to my countrymen in Hebrew, and spoke on national TV for 5 minutes in Hebrew while the networks didn't know what to do. The Knesset passed the agreement 84-19. Most of the opposition was Begin's comrades. Shamir was opposed. Ahrens abstained. Very shortly, it was a breakaway party from Likud called Hatzchiyah with Rav Goldman and Gula Cohn and others. Begin and Sadat won the Nobel Prize in October. Begin learned about it on a Friday night. Made no statement until Motzei Shabbos. He came out of his house. In December in Stockholm, Sadat didn't show at all. An indication of how little peace, so to speak, resonated in Egypt or the Arab world. Golda Meir died that weekend as well. In the Arab world, Al-Ahram editorialized, what did Begin do to deserve this, other than put obstacles in the way of peace? The talks dragged on again until Carter flew to the Mideast in March, put the finishing touches on a peace treaty, which was again ratified by the Knesset and signed at a White House ceremony Monday, March 26, 1979. The Arabs protested outside the White House that day. Begin spoke of this day as the third greatest day of his life, after Yom HaTzimut and Yom Yerushalayim. He recalled, very emotional, recalled the slaughter of his parents in the Holocaust. He donned the yarmulke, I'll never forget this as well, to read Tehillim Kuf Chavtes, Teshuva Hashem Hashiva Tzion, Hayinu Kechomim, in its entirety and without translation. Next week, Begin visited Cairo. He davened mincha at the Great Synagogue, the old shul in Cairo, went to the pyramids. Even though Israel and Egypt would soon exchange ambassadors and embassies, Egypt's embassy to this day is in the Tel Aviv Hotel, relations founded on the autonomy portion. There's no one to talk to. Yosef Borg became the head of the autonomy talks, but they're talking to another party, but the party that should be there was not there. 2 weeks later, April 1979, Shiloh was recognized as a settlement. On the same day, terrorists broke into an apartment building in Nahariya, killed a father and a young daughter. A second daughter was smothered to death by her mother, hiding in a closet from the terrorists. That terrorist, Samir Kantar, is still in Israeli custody, and his release is being demanded today by Hezbollah, who holds two Israeli soldiers kidnapped in July 2006. And they said they will not release the two captured, Regev and Goldwasser, unless Samir Kantar is released. June 5, Syrian MiGs are shot down in a dogfight over Lebanon. The first time F-15s are used in battle. Lebanon, terror, world pressure, none of this would go away. Egyptian peace treaty brought hope and a burst of optimism. It removed Egypt from the rejectionist front, the largest Arab nation, but it did enshrine land for peace as the only possible process. So after that, anything short of all land for peace would never work, and the Arabs realized they could gain in talks what they could not win in war. Now that strategy was first suggested in the 60s by Tunisian President Habib Bourguiba, recognize Israel in the 1947 borders, and then when it's indefensible, destroy it. That became the PLO's phases plan of 1974. They'll accept a state, any land vacated by Israel, as a step to recovering the entire land. Some analysts would say that's what Egypt did here, recover its land and then wait 20 years, 30 years, 50 years for the next round. That strategy of waiting Israel out, sapping its strength and will through terror and negotiations, would take on a life of its own in the 1980s and the 1990s. I thank you very much. Next week, the 1980s.